Good evening, everybody. James McCann here with my Science Hour. This is for May 4th, 2023. And last week, I went into some details on objects passing by Earth, pole shifts, and things like that. And it was, in a sense, an introduction. There's not many radio shows where you can go and get actual physics lessons, celestial mechanics, astronomy, astrophysics, and actually come away with any understanding. 99.99% of everything you hear today is based on outdated theories that have no meaning at all, just are literally could not be true. And that falls over into the realm of geology, anthropology, archaeology, meteorology, and the list goes on. So here's the deal. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the situation with drastic effects on Earth from objects that pass by. And so I went into some detail last week about how actual pole shifts work. But I think it's going to be informative if we take a known object like the moon. We know about the tides. Everybody who has any knowledge of Earth science at all understands that the moon, in conjunction with the sun's gravitational fields, causes something called tides. And so here's the way it works. Basically, the moon moves very slowly in its orbit. It goes around Earth once a month. So basically, every day, we spin underneath the moon. So every point on Earth is at one point closest to the moon and then farthest away from the moon as the Earth spins on its axis. And so what happens, the close side of the Earth to the moon is pulled harder than the center of the Earth. This is called a differential force, and tidal force is another term for this. And so literally, the close side of Earth is being pulled away harder than the center of the Earth, so that creates a bulge in the Earth's oceans of up to 20 feet. That's quite a bit for a lunar object that's 250,000 miles away. The Earth is the moon is pretty far from the Earth, let's just put it that way, where it orbits the Earth. Now, the far side of Earth, the side that's farthest away from the moon, the opposite happens. The moon's gravitational fields pulls with less force on the far side of Earth, so then it, in a sense, falls away, causing a bulge on that side. So you get this dual bulge, and it's a gravitational effect. And it's a differential gravitational effect because the force on the close side of the Earth is greater and the force on the far side of the Earth is less. So it's a differential force, or called a tidal force. And it there are ways of mathematically modeling this, but we'll use some general terms here. And now, because of the physical reality, this is not a perfect formula, but let's just talk about gravity itself, is a 1 over r squared force. What does that mean? That means if the moon would be twice as far away, the force of gravity due to the moon would be 1/4. If it's 3 times as far away, the force of gravity due to the moon would be 1/9. It's the square, the inverse square, actually, of the relative distance. Okay, so now that's a 1 over r squared force. This differential force we're talking about is a 1 over r cubed. And so if the moon is twice as far away, it's 1/8. 2 times 2 times 2 is 1/8 as much. If it's 3 times away, it's 1/27. So it drops off very quickly. The reverse side of that is if you get closer, it goes up very quickly. Okay, so if you are one half the distance from the moon closer to Earth, the tides of Earth, say, and this is a real example, say the moon were half the distance that it is now from Earth. The moon is half the distance, in other words, right now it's a quarter million miles away, 250,000 miles. If it were 125,000 miles, half the distance, the differential force would be eight times as great. Not four times, which is the formula for gravity. It would be eight times because it goes as the cube. If the moon were one-third the distance, that force, that differential force, would go up to 27 times. If it were one-fourth the distance that it is right now, it would be 4 cubed, which would be 64 times as much. So now you can see what's going on here. Say there was a comet coming through the solar system, and it was, the nucleus was the size of the moon. Now, right here, if you were a standard astronomer, you'd be going, oh, there cannot be such a big nucleus of a comet. Well, let me tell you something, boys and girls. Yeah, they get a lot bigger than that. They'll get up to the size of Jupiter and bigger. And they have. And they've come by Earth, and they've done major damage to Earth. And so, anyway, let's get back to the example of the moon, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down to a little bit smaller, something half the mass of the moon, and then we're going to double the mass of the moon, quadruple, multiplied by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, all the way up to, then we're going to jump up to something the size of, say, Earth itself, and then we would go up to something, say, eventually the size of Jupiter. Now, there are other factors here. As Earth spins on its axis, the surface of the Earth relative to the moon, now the Earth is spinning on its axis, and it spins once every 24 hours, and the Earth's circumference is about 25,000 miles. And so that's 25,000 miles in 24 hours. So roughly, just roughly, we say that's 1,000 miles an hour. So the Earth is moving, the Earth's surface, if you're standing on the Earth around the equator and you're seeing the moon up above you, we are going at about 1,000 miles an hour relative to the moon. So the tide, this swelling of the ocean, is moving across the surface of the ocean at 1,000 miles per hour. Now, let's take another example here. As the tide in the ocean lifts by about 20 feet, the tide in the land mass of Earth is about 1 inch. And we have a wave that's moving 1,000 miles an hour. Now imagine the Earth's crust. You're sitting in your desk. You don't feel this because it's very slight and it happens relatively quickly, but it's not something you actually notice or feel. But if you were on a boat on the ocean, or if you were standing on the shore and watching the tide come in and go back out, you would notice that within a period of an hour, the tide would come in to maximum, and then it would start going out to where it was a minimum 6 hours later. Then it would rise again, and then 6 hours later it would drop again. Okay, so this was the same with that 1 inch rise in the surface of the Earth. Okay, now keeping everything constant, the Earth is going to have, let's say the moon comes in half the distance. Guess what? It's going to be it's going to be moving faster in its orbit, but not significantly much more So really, the velocity, the relative, the velocity, if you're standing on the equator, that 1,000 miles per hour is not going to change a whole lot. But the rise in the sea level, if the moon were half the distance, remember what's going on, half the distance, eight times. So instead of a 20-foot tide, all of a sudden you've got a 160-foot tide. Okay, now imagine New York City or the coastal cities on the in the New England or down the eastern seaboard or the western coastal cities. You would have the ocean level rising by 160 feet every 6 hours. It would rise, and 6 hours later it would drop down to low tide, and then 6 hours later it would rise up to high tide again. And this would go on a daily basis. So most of New York City would be inundated. And I'm not talking about global warming or any of that mishmash. I'm talking about the tide of the moon, and these are hypothetical examples, because I want you to understand what happens when a big comet comes through the solar system. Okay, so now there, I'll just give you a little hint here. From a physics point of view, it can be fairly complicated because it depends on what angle this object is coming from. If a big comet nuclei were coming by Earth, is it coming over the pole? Is it coming around the equator? Is it somewhere between one of those? But there's other factors. So there's the mass of the object. And remember, this is not a collision. This is not something smacking and hitting Earth. This is simply a gravitational wave. By the way, there are other effects. Electrical effects, electrical discharges, tug of war between the atmospheres, electromagnetic interactions, many different types of electromagnetic interactions. It would affect the orbit of the moon, the orbit of Earth. All kinds of factors would come into play here. All kinds of things would change. But I'm trying to stay just focused on, a lot of times when you do physics problems, you just stay focused on one aspect of it so you can understand that aspect. And then after you understand the electromagnetic aspect, you put them all together. Right now we're just working on the gravitational effects. Okay, so now if you the moon were one-third the distance, it would be 27 times. So 27 times 20 feet, your tide now is going to be 540 feet tall. So that would be a real game changer. Now you'd have to go in, if you were building a city or infrastructure or finding a place to farm, you would have to go in to where the water line for an altitude of 540 feet before you would get above the high tide line. That would be a really an amazing thing. Now imagine it's one-fourth the distance. The moon is one-fourth the distance. The tide would be 1,280 feet, or about a quarter of a mile high. So now you'd have to build your city, infrastructure, farm, whatever you were doing, at a level where the ocean tide of almost a quarter mile would not inundate your project, your city, your farm, or whatever. Okay, so that just gives you an idea. We have relatively mild tides because of the distance that the moon is from planet Earth. Okay, now if the moon went farther away, the tides would get smaller very quickly. And so, as I said, it's the tidal forces are considered to be a 1 over r cubed force, or a differential force. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to increase the mass of the moon. Now, the force of gravity is, once again, it's a 1 over r squared force, so it depends on the distance between the object and Earth, in this case the moon and the Earth. But if you doubled the mass of the moon, it would double the gravitational force, and all of these other equations would fall into line equally. And so distance is very sensitive, let's just put it that way. The size of the object is linear. If you double the moon, size, mass, it's going to double the gravitational force. Okay, whereas if you double the distance from the moon, it's going to be 1/4 the gravitational force and 1/8 the differential force. So the differential force, the one that causes the tide, drops off very quickly with distance. But if you have the mass of the moon, it's only going to half the differential force. Okay, so that's another factor. The first factor we talked about was distance, the distance of the moon from Earth. The second factor was size, or another way of putting that is mass. The correct physics term would be mass. Now, velocity. This is the one that really is the kicker. And so let us imagine you're out, you're building a house, you're building a project in the backyard. You've got some 2x4s and you've got a nail there. You want to pound that nail through one 2x4 and into the next one to hold them together. Take your hammer and just press on that nail. Just press on it as hard as you can, and I bet you you're not going to drive that nail very far into the wood. It's not going to go far. But what happens when you swing that hammer and boom, all of the momentum that's in the head of that hammer now is transferred into the nail, and the nail goes driving down into the piece of wood. That's momentum transfer. You're transferring it from the head of the hammer into the nail, and it's based on velocity. So if you swing that hammer head twice as fast, it's going to drive the nail. It's going to be twice as great an impulse. And so the term here in physics is impulse. It's a rapid change in force. It's a rapid change in momentum of one object transferring that momentum into the other object. And that's what happens when you swing a hammer and hit a nail. When a large object comes by Earth, sending a gravitational wave into the Earth, now remember I told you that the gravitational wave set up by the moon, the Earth is spinning on its axis, we're moving about 1,000 miles an hour. Okay, that's a lot of energy on the Earth's surface. But what if this object is coming by at, let's say, 20,000 miles an hour, 20,000 miles an hour, instead of 1,000 miles an hour. Now you have an impulse. It's like the hammer hitting the nail. All of a sudden, the Earth is sitting there, nice tranquil day, everything is great. All of a sudden, this object comes by, and it only takes about less than 12 hours to pass by. And in that time, dispenses this huge impulsive force on the surface of the Earth. Okay, so now in our hypothetical physics problem here, which is not so hypothetical because these things have happened, and I want to preface this also by saying, so that somebody doesn't run off, you know, trying to make a story that where there isn't one, I am not saying that this is going to happen imminently in the near future or that there is something inbound or anything else. There's been so much misinformation. And by the way, whenever there's a big object in the solar system that could affect Earth, very, very rarely does it ever actually have a great effect on planet Earth. That these close encounters are extremely rare. Even though there's a lot of planetary-sized objects out there, especially in the Kuiper Belt where we don't have any orbital information. But I just want to reiterate, I'm not talking about doom and gloom and something happening in the near future or anything like that. So these are events that have happened in the past to Earth, and it's important to understand them within their context. So now, once again, in this hypothetical physics problem, which I say also is not so hypothetical because these things have happened, the three main factors involved in this planetary interaction, like game of billiards, you might want to call it, three main factors are the size of the object, the relative the distance from the object to Earth, the surface of the Earth and the center of the Earth, and the relative velocity relative to the surface of the Earth. Now, to have a pole shift, the object has to come either over the North Pole or the South Pole. If it comes around laterally around the equatorial region of Earth and passes by then, you still get this tremendous jolt and impulse and gravitational wave, but you don't get the pole shift because it's moving along with the Earth or against the Earth's rotation. So anyway, there may have been other events where we had major interactions, mountain building, tsunamis, mass extinctions, etc., that are not recorded in terms of a pole shift. In fact, let me throw something else in here. It's called Noah's Flood. We spent, as Earth, as a human race, about 40 days and 40 nights inside the tail of a comet, and that was the Noah's Flood, torrential rain that came from outside. And of course, standard science doesn't understand nor recognize this. They want to come up with all kinds of other excuses. But there again, that did not involve a pole shift. It involved the dramatic increase in ocean levels by many hundreds of feet. And so it's really difficult to sort all of these different major events. It's difficult to sort them out because there are just so many mixed effects that are going on. And how do you know that one is related to a certain pole shift and not the other one? It's very, very difficult. And then there are other things going on planet Earth also that are not related to pole shifts. So anyway, looking back through a looking glass into our history is very, very difficult. Okay, now I'm going to do a little segue here. We're going to do a little physics problem. And it's a very interesting physics problem. And it's something that requires you, it actually is a problem that comes out in electromagnetic theory, conducting bodies in electric fields. It comes out in many different ways in theoretical physics. But here we're going to be talking about gravitational fields. And let's say now when you do classical physics, and especially when you're starting out, you have what you call point sources. So Earth would be a point, the Moon would be a point, Jupiter would be a point, the Sun would be a point, and it would have a certain amount of mass. And you concentrate all the mass, even though it's a physically large object like the Sun or Earth, or Jupiter, you concentrate all the mass into the center point, at the very center of the star or the planet or whatever. And now, one could object and say, well, maybe that's not the way it really is. Because if you take a test object, a test point, and put it out in outer space, and then let's take something that's a perfect sphere, and the Earth is a very good example, we're a very near perfect sphere, not perfect, but close enough. The side of the Earth that's closer to the test point is closer, so therefore the gravitational field from all of that matter on that side of the Earth, on that side of the center point, would be closer, so that would add up to be a certain force, and it would be greater than if you put all of the mass at the center of the Earth. Now, on the far side of Earth, the gravitational force, because it's farther away from our test point, is less. So how does this balance out? And it turns out, once you start doing two, three-dimensional integrations with calculus, this is one of the beauties of Newton's work, because they knew this way back when. If you do an integral over the entire sphere and calculate, and assuming, of course, that this object like the Earth has a constant density or a radial density that is the same, then it turns out to be true that it's the same as if you took all of the mass of that object, planet Earth in our test case here, it put it all at that center point, and that is the end force on our test point. So it turns out that the gravitational field from the material that's closer to the test point balances with the material, the mass that's away from the center point on the far side from our test point. And it turns out that it's the same exact force as if you took all the mass and put it at the very center point of our sphere. Very interesting physics result, because now when we're doing our differential force, we can just take an object like, say, let's take the moon and let's replace it with Jupiter. Okay, then we can just replace that test point that we're calling the moon, the position of the moon, that has physical size to it, and we could replace it with Jupiter, and that would, all of that mass of Jupiter would reside in that point. A very, very important physical result that you can prove using calculus and Newton's law, the 1 over r squared inverse square gravitational law for gravity. And so, very interesting result. Now, let's look at the diameter of Jupiter. The radius of Jupiter is 43,441 miles. Okay, and so the distance from Earth to the Moon is 250,000 miles. So, if we put Jupiter where our Moon is, it would be still quite distant. It would not fill up that entire 250,000-mile space between where the Moon is and Earth. It would be closer, but using the result that we just got here, that all of the mass of Jupiter could be put in a single point at its very center, simplifies greatly the entire problem of calculating the waves, the gravitational waves, etc. So now, let's take a look at the mass of Jupiter. It turns out that Jupiter's mass is around 26,000 times the mass of our moon. Okay, so now let's take the same scenario. We put Jupiter where the moon is, and this is kind of a nonsensical problem in a sense. But in this case, since Jupiter is much bigger, Earth would be in orbit around Jupiter. But at any rate, the end tidal results would be very much the same. So we can live with the fact that the moon orbits Earth, in a sense. It's on a, I'm not going to go into more detail than that, but if Jupiter were out there where the moon was, Earth would be orbiting Jupiter. But the end result is, when we're talking about the tidal forces, they would be the same. Okay, so now we have a mass, Jupiter, because we've just put it where the moon was, we have a mass that's 26,000 times more than the mass of the moon. So that means that using a simple gravitational equation, the force of gravity at Earth due to Jupiter being at that location where the moon is, would be 26,000 times, because the gravitational force is the mass of the main body times the mass of the smaller body orbiting divided by r squared, the distance between them. So by replacing Jupiter or by replacing the moon with Jupiter, we have a gravitational force that is 26,000 times greater than the force of the moon, which means we're going to have a tidal wave on Earth that is about 46,000 times greater than what the moon provides. So this is staggering. This, what this literally means, and there's a problem in physics, classical celestial mechanics physics. It's called the Roche limit. And what it means is that if something like Earth got close enough to Jupiter within its gravitational field, that the tidal forces would literally rip the object apart. And that would certainly be the case with Earth. So at any rate, imagine a Jupiter-sized object now coming through the solar system. It's a large, raging comet discharging the solar capacitor. It comes relatively near Earth, but at a very high velocity. So you have this huge mass, 26,000 times that of the moon. It's coming not at 1,000 miles an hour, which is our relative velocity relative to the moon, when the moon is in orbit around Earth, but imagine it's 20,000 miles an hour, or 20 times the velocity. And now imagine that it comes even closer to Earth than the moon. I mean, it's going to rip the snot out of Earth. Earth is not going to be the same afterwards. In fact, what would happen additionally is that Jupiter-sized object would connect electrically with Earth and would literally pull the atmosphere and oceans off of Earth. And that is what happened to Mars. The ancients talk about Venus the comet coming by Mars and pulling its atmosphere and oceans. That Mars had been a blue planet up to that point, and something the size of Venus, which is not even as big as Earth, was able to pull the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars. Okay, now Venus subsequently had two interactions with Earth, one that was not so devastating, and one that was extremely devastating. And from what we understand, now this is where things get difficult to put together in terms of calendars. Velikovsky put this date at 1500 BC. Now the question is, was there a pole shift during that event? And that was the demise of the mastodons, we think, as little as 1500 BC. But could that have been a mass extinction event, but not including the mastodons? And a lot of people believe that the mastodon fauna and flora went under around 11,000 to 12,000 BC. And of course, man was hunting mastodons during that time when the mastodons were on planet Earth. So anyway, it gets very difficult to know, to sort all of these things out. Okay, well, let's go back to the idea of pole shift here. And large objects coming through the solar system. Now, I went all the way up to Jupiter, 26,000 times the mass of the moon. Clearly, it would not be a good day when those might come by planet Earth. But if you look at the photograph on the cover of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, it's a picture of an Indian petroglyph, Native American petroglyph, because from the Green River, Utah area, the original photograph, which I used in the book, was taken by Gary Smith, I think was his name. He was a guy who was in a wheelchair, but he went out and he did a lot of photography out in the country, and he sent me that picture, gave me permission to use it on the cover of my Planet X book, and it's been there ever since. But it shows two comets And one of them does not have a nucleus. The other one does, and they both have these squiggly little sunward spikes coming out the nose side of them, clearly indicating that they were highly electromagnetic. But the one that has the nucleus visible shows it almost completely filling up the coma of the comet, which could be around 100,000 miles across. So the end result is that that comet that the Native Americans drew a picture of, and they had a shaman-like character with his arms out showing how big it was, you know, and a little other kind of character there, also with his arms outstretched, with a look of surprise. And then also a snake, which looked like it was about to capture a planetary type of object up in the sky. All of this very symbolic of comets, of snakes, of serpents, which represented comets in the ancient mythology and lore. So at any rate, that would indicate that that comet had a nucleus potentially the size of Jupiter. And we're not aware that that came near Earth or did any damage. We just have this Native American petroglyph showing the size of the nucleus, which we can use as scientific data. So the you know, and typically too, when you look at comets, I don't care if it's Halley's Comet or any of the other comets that have come by Earth, you do not see the nucleus. You never see the nucleus because typically they're very small. They're shrouded in the coma. Even when they pass between the sun and Earth, you typically cannot see the nucleus. In fact, there was one incident where a comet came between Earth and the sun, and astronomers were able to see the nucleus, and that was the first time they understood that, yes, there was something inside that comet. And that was like in the 1950s, as I recall. It took them that long to actually identify that a comet had a nucleus. There was something in there. Prior to that, there were theories that the comet tail was a dust, just a conglomeration of dust that stretched out when it came near the sun, or dust and sand. There were all kinds of hypotheses. But that solidified, that observation solidified the concept that the comet had a nucleus. And somehow that nucleus, of course, was part and parcel central to the entire comet process. And the best they could come up with, of course, at the time, was this dirty snowball thing. And, you know, okay, that's fine. But, I mean, we're in the year 2023, boys and girls, and it's time to let go of that dead horse. Okay, so at any rate, getting back to the idea, now let's go to, say, Venus coming by Earth and relative to the moon. So this is going to give us our first real-world example, because we know Venus, the comet, came by Earth. We know its relative size to Earth. So it's a very good example. Okay, so the moon relative to Venus, this is Venus as we know it today, the mass of Venus. Venus is 66 times the mass of our moon. So let's replace our moon with Venus. See what happens. Now the tides in the ocean would go from 20 feet to 1,320 feet, which is literally a quarter of a mile. So now you have Venus creating tidal waves, tsunamis, that are a quarter of a mile tall, and this is why the mythology of the Mayan Indians and everybody else talked about Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus, causing and carrying the oceans on its back to cause great tsunamis. But what about the tsunami in the Earth's surface? Well, typically with the moon, it's about 1 inch. So multiply that times 66, and you come out to about 5.5 feet. So it's not only is it not really big, the gravitational wave in the Earth's surface. What if it's coming really fast? Say it's coming at 20,000 miles an hour relative velocity. Now all of a sudden you have that impulse factor. Remember the hammer hitting the nail. So it's a very good illustration of something that is near Earth size. The other thing that would happen is it would cause a tremendous amount of pollution, because the nucleus of Venus comet would be smaller than Earth. So in the tug of war for the atmospheres, Earth would win. Earth would pull material out of the comet tail, so in the form of hydrocarbons, water, and this is what the ancients observed. The ancients observed these phenomena. So if you go through the plagues of Egypt that happened as the comet approached, and then the pillar of fire reaching up into the sky, that was the electrical discharge. The parting of the Red Sea was the water washing back and forth, allowing the Israelites with Moses to pass across. And when they got to the other side, that narrow passage in the Red Sea, we know exactly where they crossed. Pharaoh went in after them, and here comes the big ocean wave just washing back and killed them. And we know that that happened because they have found the chariots. They found the Pharaoh's chariots in the Red Sea. That story is truth. And of course, everybody wants to make it up as if it's fake. But I remember the day they found those and then published it, and it was actually in National Geographic. That was back when National Geographic was actually a decent magazine. Of course, now it's corrupted and owned by the Rothschild Empire, evil empire, banking empire, the front agency for the Vatican Bank. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, so now the question really arises, because now let's take a look at what Velikovsky did. He took and thinking that there was only one event, and this is a problem that exists today with new people that are picking up these themes, is that they're trying to suggest that everything we're discovering, which ended in a catastrophic end, happened in one event, and it's simply not true. There were many of these events, and the Venus event, which from the best reckoning we can make of it, Velikovsky, I think, had the best reckoning, was probably correct in dealing with it around 1500 BC. But the big question now is that could Venus, given what we know about it today, given what we know about the physics of pole shifts, could Venus have created a pole shift? And I'm starting to think that it was not. That the Venus event was severe. It was the differentiation between when the Israelites left Egypt, the Mayans, where they had a mass extinction down through the Yucatan Peninsula in south, Belize, Quintana Roo, down into Guatemala, Honduras. But they survived. And that was possibly the end of the Toltecs in northern Mexico, the Olmecs in southern Mexico, the early pre-Inca civilizations in South America, and many other civilizations around the world. But could Venus have had enough power to create a pole shift of the 25 to 30 degree magnitude that we see at the beginning, at the beginning of the Holocene period, where the mastodons died off? That appears to be a different pole shift event. And so we have now the Venus event, which may have occurred around 1500 BC. We have the Noah's flood, which may have occurred around 6000 BC. I'm just pulling these numbers kind of out of the air. Neither one of those dealing with a pole shift, and then the last event, pole shift, where we really had a major pole shift, was around 11,000 BC. That's the way it is looking now, but I would not put the nail in any coffin yet on any one of these events. We simply don't know. We don't have enough data at this point. Okay, now at this point, I want to do a segue. Last week, you have to listen to last week's show to put this week's show into perspective. But I talked about a book, a couple books actually, one of them written by a friend of mine, Mark Gaffney. It's called Deep History and the Ages of Man. It's in its second production volume. It's available on Amazon. And this Mark Gaffney with two F's. And it's about a 300-page book, and it's pretty dense if you're not familiar with anthropology, archaeology, and the concept of pole shifts and things like that. That's one book. And then the other book is my own book, which has the title The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. And I wrote that book specifically to address the idea that there have been multiple pole shifts and that we really don't have 100% knowledge of all of these things. Mark's book makes a lot of headway in understanding that there were four major pole shifts in the last 120,000 years, and applying mollusk data, movement of sea creatures because of temperature changes, and a lot of other data, the mastodons, mass extinctions, the early Holocene period, etc., and the transformation of Earth. But we have these other two kind of events which are very sore thumbs. And so I'm going to call the one the Venus event, the Velikovsky event, or the Moses event. Those are the three names I'll give the one which potentially occurred around 1500 BC. But it was not a major pole shift at that point, because Venus simply did not have enough oomph to cause that large of a pole shift. And we know how big the last pole shift was. It was a good 25 degrees, more or less, from the current North Pole. And that's when the Laurentian ice cap melted. And so then we have the Noah's event, the Noah's flood, which again was not a pole shift. It was simply Earth passing through the tail of a large comet. And when they say 40 days and 40 nights, I want to reiterate that 40 in the biblical term was a large number. It was like saying a million. It was one, two, three, many. But if you said 40 in the Bible, it was basically so long that you couldn't remember when it started. So you have many references to 40 in the Bible. You have Jesus going into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights with the temptation of the devil. But did he really go for 40 days and 40 nights? No, it was just many, more than you could remember. When we talk about the Noah's flood, they talk about 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. Okay, well, that's great. But was it 40 days and 40 nights? Well, it was just a long time, because if you're out in the ocean, if you're Noah and you're out in this ship that you built and it's full of animals, I mean, you're going to, there's no sunlight, it's raining, you're in this torrential rain for long period of time, you're simply going to lose track of time. He didn't have a Rolex. He didn't have a timepiece. He didn't have a stopwatch. He didn't even have a sand, what do you call it, like an hourglass. And so when they say 40 days and 40 nights, it was just one heck of a long time until it finally cleared up and they passed out of the tail of the comet. And then they floated around till they finally... And the way they did this, the same technique as the Polynesians, they would let a bird go, and if the bird came back, then the bird did not find land. But if the bird did not come back, they knew that land was nearby. That's the way the Polynesians worked it. And so, at any rate, then the Earth's oceans had changed. And if you look at the Old Testament, it's really a genealogy. It's a genealogy throughout history of the race of man that developed, that brought us down to where we are today. And if you look at, for example, Christ of the house of David, of the house, you know, of the lineage of Abraham, the Israelites, all of this is the Old Testament. That's what it is. It's a discussion of the lineage and these major events, the Noah's flood. They talk about the Genesis, the Noah's flood, and the Moses event. Those are the big events in history. And then when Christ came along, his lineage was very well known. He was an Israelite, blonde hair, blue-eyed, from the house of David. Very clear history, which has been distorted completely by, I'm not going to go into that right now, but I've talked about that subject before. Okay, now to cap off this discussion, I'm going to give one more example. In place of the moon that's orbiting the Earth, I'm going to put an object that's four Earth masses. Okay, so the Earth is about, Earth is about 80 times the mass of the moon. So something that is four Earth masses, because the Earth is not that much bigger than Venus, so I'm not going to give that example. But something that is four Earth masses, something on the order of Uranus, something pretty big, but not colossal like Jupiter. So we have something, in fact, this is what the estimates were that got back to me through various means, actually calculating, etc. The nucleus of Hale-Bopp could have been as many as four Earth masses, but we don't know. We don't know for certain. Because NASA, of course, falsified the data and lied to the public about the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. Okay, so let's see what's going to happen. Something four Earth masses, we put it out there by the moon, and we look at the tides. So all of a sudden we have 320 times the mass of the moon, an object that's four Earth masses, 320 times the mass of the moon. So that means 320 times 20 feet. Okay, so the normal 20-foot tide from our moon all of a sudden turns into a 6,000-foot tidal wave on the ocean. And if this is moving faster, then you have that impulse. And instead of a 1-inch tidal wave in the Earth's surface, now you have 27 feet. Much more significant. And this is coming through, say, at 20,000 miles an hour. All of a sudden, now you have some serious impulse force going on here from an object that's four times the mass of Earth, if it's coming that close. If it comes farther away, then the effects will diminish very quickly because, once again, it's a 1 over r cubed force, the tidal forces. Okay, so I think that should give you a very good idea of tidal forces, of gravitational effects that can cause pole shifts. I have not talked about electromagnetic effects. I have not talked about weather effects. I have not talked about atmospheric effects. I have not talked about many, many other factors, things like breaking down Earth's magnetic field that could cause an influx of cosmic rays that could send Earth genetic DNA structure into just a tizzy. I didn't talk about any of this. So there are many, many other factors to consider. I'm just talking about the gravitational effects, and that's how you have to look at these extremely complex problems. In a physics sense, you can't attack them all at one time. You have to take them one at a time and then start to combine them to understand the overall effects. So I hope these two lectures last week and this week help you get an understanding of what it takes to cause a pole shift. So it appears that it would take something at least four Earth masses coming by Earth relatively close to Earth, probably no farther than the moon, a single lunar distance, LD, they're called lunar distance, and possibly coming at a speed of 15 to 20,000 miles an hour to cause a significant pole shift. And of course, this being very important because now it appears that the Venus event, the Moses event, the Velikovsky event, did not have enough oomph to create the pole shift, the last pole shift that we know happened, which very well puts that back around 11,000 years ago. Okay, so, and once again, these are round numbers. Nobody's putting exact numbers on these because we simply don't know yet. We're starting to realize some of these facts, but still there's a lot of, every time you have something you think you answered, it raises 2 or 3 or 10 or 15 other questions. Okay, well, I'm going to talk right now, the last couple minutes here, about my water filters. They are on sale. The sale is going away. I've extended it a little bit because there's going to be some other radio shows. Later tonight, I'll be on with Jeff Rentz talking about the issues of mountain building. Very important topic related to what we're talking about tonight. And physically looking at mountain building processes. But I'll also be talking about the water filters. And so for that reason, we're extending the sale. The MR5 whole house water filters, tremendous savings right now. That's going to go away. So go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and consider this for Mother's Day. What better gift could you give the mom in your family, the wife, the mom, the person that is central to your entire family than the gift of clean water? Whether it's a sink filter, whether it's a whole house water filter, whether it's a set of filter elements for the old stainless steel gravity filter that you've got sitting in the corner and not using, whatever it is, consider the gift that keeps on giving every day, just like mom, every day, giving, giving, giving without thought. That's what a water filter does. It gives you clean water every day in the kitchen. And I have the best ones on the planet with the best pricing. So once again, the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And also don't forget my new book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. And throw another plug in here for Mark's book on Amazon, Deep History and the Ages of Man. So go to Amazon, both of those books available there. And I'm out of time. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.